Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Ahead, reaction to a U.S. presidential candidate's remarks on Muslim immigration. A look at a new report on where Islamic State is getting its weapons. The U.S. Secretary of State urges passage of a new climate accord. And a television movie looks at a special moment in country singer Dolly Parton's life.
The coat really becomes an anchor in the film, signifying resiliency, renewal, faith, and most importantly, love.
Coming up right here on The Voice of America. U.S. and world leaders have roundly criticized real estate billionaire and 2016 Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump, who has called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until Congress can consider the immigration issue. Despite the criticism, Trump declined to back down during a phone interview on the ABC television program Good Morning America.
What I'm doing is I'm calling very simply for a shutdown of Muslims entering the United States, and here's a key, until our country's representatives can figure out what is going on. I hope it will go quickly. I hope we can figure it out. But we have to look at people. We have to use vigilance in our country, or we're going to have many more World Trade Centers, and our country will never be the same.
International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with some experts who have different assessments of these remarks and joins us to talk about it. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you, Sue.
How did Muslim Americans receive Trump's statement?
One of them is Saba Ahmed, president and founder of the Muslim Republican Coalition, who said almost all Muslim American leaders denounced such remarks, which they deemed not only un-American, but also serving ISIS' agenda of trying to drive a wedge between the West and Muslims across the globe.
Well, his comments are extremely offensive, and they are very unconstitutional. He can't just enact laws by himself, and especially because they are against the Constitution. We have the equal protection of the law for all people, and there is no religious trust that allows him to discriminate against Muslims.
Ms. Ahmed said Republican leaders were fast to condemn his remarks because the Republican Party stands for religious freedom for everyone. And she was right about that, because House Speaker Paul Ryan said Trump's proposal to bar Muslims until U.S. leaders can figure out what's going on is not what the Republican Party or the country stands for. He said freedom of religion is a fundamental constitutional principle. It is a founding principle of this country. Saba Ahmed said while Muslim American leaders and scholars were quick to condemn homegrown terrorism, that's not enough in her view to counter a campaign of frightening Americans from their fellow Muslim American citizens as a potential security threat.
Muslim Americans need to get more involved in the national security discussion and have our policy insights. We can provide them with the solution to our national security challenges. And that's going to change the minds of a lot of people when they see Muslims working side by side to fight the war on terror.
Trump said that polling data shows hatred toward Americans by large segments of the Muslim population. And he said, our country cannot be the victim of horrendous attacks by people that believe only in jihad and have no sense of reason or respect for human life.
I spoke to Daniel Pipes, founder of Middle East Forum, and he agrees that several polls have shown a great hostility toward the United States among Muslim populations, but he acknowledged that it is not 100% hostility, and it is a mistake to generalize that all Muslims hate the United States. Pipes said the United States should differentiate between radical Islam as the problem and moderate Islam as the solution, and that was the mistake, he said, Trump had committed.
I think he is representing a growing view in the United States, one that does not distinguish between Muslims. It sees every Muslim as a possible member of ISIS. And I think that's a great mistake. I think one has to be very careful, because in the end, what we're witnessing now is a civil war among Muslims. Between Muslims who wish to modernize, and Muslims at the other extreme who wish to return to the 7th century.
Pipes suggested that Trump should have made it clear that the United States should use a more thorough inspection and vetting procedures to prevent Islamists, he calls the enemies of this country, from entering the United States.
Thank you, Mohammed, for that report.
Thank you for having me.
Donald Trump is using social media, criticizing those who attack him, and even getting some high-profile support. Michael Lippin is here with more on that. Welcome, Michael.
Hi.
Who's coming to Trump's defense?
Well, Susan, I can tell you that it's British journalist Piers Morgan, who is a friend of Trump's. And Morgan tweeted out a message on Wednesday accusing many of his fellow Britons of hypocrisy. A British petition calling for Trump to be banned from entering the country has attracted more than 200,000 signatures, more than enough for a committee to consider sending that motion to Parliament for a debate. Now, Morgan, whose Twitter handle is @PiersMorgan, responded to that by saying this: "Have any of the 200,000-plus Brits who have signed the petition to ban Trump signed any petition to ban UK terror suspects returning from Iraq and Syria?" Now, Morgan has 4.7 million followers, not far behind Trump, who has 5.1 million. And the American liked Morgan's rhetorical question, retweeting it and adding this comment: "Thank you, Piers. They don't know what they're getting into." Now, Trump has also been responding directly to his critics, as he loves to do, sending out this tweet a few hours ago: "Wow, what a day. So many foolish people that refuse to acknowledge the tremendous danger and uncertainty of some people coming into the U.S.
Well, what have Trump's critics been tweeting about lately, Michael?
Well, you know, Trump has a huge number of critics on Twitter, and for the past day or two, they've been using a new hashtag to mock him, the hashtag Trump is disqualified party. Now, that plays on a comment from a White House spokesman who this week said Trump's call for a temporary ban on almost all Muslims entering the U.S. should disqualify Trump from being president. So the anti-Trump crowd on Twitter have been having fun with that hashtag, using it to post photo and video memes. They're writing tweets saying things like, "Arriving at the Trump is disqualified party is like... dot, dot, dot," and then showing a picture or a looping video of someone dancing or celebrating and having a party. But another Twitter user who used the hashtag posted a more downbeat image. The user wrote, "When you see hashtag Trump is disqualified party, but then you see he's not actually disqualified." And the image shows a picture of a woman screaming in agony. Susan?
Oh, well, thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Many of those who argue against human causation of climate change often point to a number of Earth's past climatic events and periods, such as the Little Ice Age and the medieval warm period, as examples of natural climate change. But now a new study suggests that the medieval warm period, or medieval climate anomaly, a time of unusually warm weather between the years 900 and 1300, may not have been the global event that had been thought. Studying beryllium-10 isotopes in boulders left in Greenland by thousands of years of glacial movement, the researchers found that the rocks were deposited by advancing glaciers between 975 and 1275. The researchers find that the concept of the medieval warm period may be Eurocentric than global. Recent research has also found evidence that areas of the world may have actually cooled off during that time. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Rights group Amnesty International says the arms used by Islamic State militants to carry out their horrific campaigns, they were largely seized from Iraqi military stockpiles. Amnesty's advocacy director for the Middle East and North Africa, Sanjeev Berry, is with me on the line here. What can you tell us about your new report on this?
Amnesty International's latest report documents how decades of irresponsible weapons sales from Russia, China, the United States, and over two dozen other countries to Iraq have created the environment in which the armed group that calls itself Islamic State is able to acquire weapons through looting Iraqi storehouses of weapons and use those weapons to enlarge its power in the region.
How is it getting it from Iraq into where they're fighting in Syria and Iraq?
Well, one of the major ways in which the armed group Islamic State is getting the weapons is simply from deserting Iraqi soldiers who have left them behind on the battlefield as Islamic State swept across parts of Iraq in 2014. In addition, however, there are black markets, there's corruption, and the United States and other governments have done a very poor job of ensuring that the Iraqi security forces and the Iraqi government have the system set up in place to make sure that weapons that are sold to the Iraqi government don't end up in third-party hands.
What can really be done about this?
Well, the first step is to adopt a posture of presumption of denial. That means that when the U.S. or other governments are receiving requests for more weapons from the Iraqi government, the Iraqi security forces, or other groups in the region that are allied with these governments and involved in the conflict, that the presumption should be on not providing any more weapons unless the recipient of the weapon can clearly show that that weapon's not going to fall in the wrong hands or be used in ways that violate human rights or international humanitarian law. So far, arms suppliers like the United States, Russia, China, and others have failed to do that. And as a consequence, we are seeing the eruptions of violence in which the armed group Islamic State is able to pick up more and more weapons as it expands its territory.
Amnesty has long spoken out about the atrocities caused by Islamic State.
Absolutely. The armed group Islamic State has been involved in crimes against humanity by systematically targeting civilian populations. You know, we've documented reports of sexual slavery, of all sorts of horrific forms of violence. And it speaks to the underlying problem in which rushed efforts to provide weapons to quote-unquote allies without concern for human rights end up creating larger problems in the longer run. And there's a significant risk that if U.S. policymakers simply repeat that approach in the Middle East today, there are going to be more whirlwinds of violence that will erupt in the days and years ahead.
Do you think the United States should put boots on the ground, so to speak, in that region?
You know, Amnesty International doesn't take a position on whether or not particular governments or parties should get involved in armed conflict. Our basic approach is to say that all parties to an armed conflict must follow the rules of international humanitarian law, including the rules of war as well as human rights law. In the armed conflict on the ground there today, there are multiple parties that have violated international humanitarian law and human rights law, and those parties should not be getting any weapons. The Syrian government should be facing an arms embargo, but Russia and China have blocked that. Obviously, Islamic State should not be getting any weapons from any parties. And there are Shia militias in Iraq that are allied with the Iraqi government that should not be getting weapons as well.
Well, thank you so much, Sanjeev, for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Coming up on International Edition, more money pledged for climate control and a turning point in Dolly Parton's life. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry urged passage of an ambitious agreement at the U.N. Climate Conference near Paris. Lisa Bryant is following the story and joins us on the line from Paris. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Susan.
Hey, please tell us about the Secretary's remarks.
Well, he really spoke. It was a very emotional, it was a very strong address. Basically, it could be summed up in just a few words, which was, let's get the job done. He said, essentially, countries have to overcome their differences, come to an ambitious agreement, as you suggested. And he also seemed to direct a big chunk of his remarks, that's what it seemed, to developing countries. He said that the U.S. and many other industrialized countries understand the plight of many of them, particularly small island states who don't account for the vast majority of greenhouse gas emissions. But he said, at the end of the day, even if the industrialized world basically had zero carbon emissions, about 65% of the carbon emissions are coming from developing countries. So it wouldn't be enough. And he also seemed to direct his message closer to home when it came to climate change skeptics, saying, you know, even if, you know, for some reason they're proved right, it was a good step to reach a climate deal.
And I understand he talked about more money for nations that can't really afford to make these changes.
Yeah, that's correct. He announced pretty much the doubling of U.S. financing for poor nations, vulnerable nations, to adapt to climate change to about $860 million.
Now, this has been a real sticking point there, the money.
Yeah, it's been one of the sticking points. Right after Kerry spoke, there was the start of a meeting by French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius. He's the guy who's sort of presiding over the climate talks, since they're being hosted by the French government here in Paris. And he said, you know, essentially there's a new draft agreement. It has been whittled down from about 43 pages to 29. A lot of the brackets, those are the areas where countries and delegates don't agree on, they have been eliminated. But there were still three major areas where negotiators are not agreeing on yet. And one of them is what they call differentiation. And that is sort of a technical jargon for distinctions between rich and poor nations. That could make a difference in terms of the financing that you're talking about and the role, the responsibility that nations have in meeting climate change objectives. The other is particularly climate financing. And the third is how ambitious the Paris Agreement should be.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Lisa. I appreciate you speaking with us.
Thanks, Susan.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Sugary donuts, soft drinks of every kind, these are common foods for many children. And child obesity rates around the world are on the rise. In the United Kingdom, a group in Parliament is proposing restrictions on junk food advertising. Childminder Jacqueline Herve wants children in her care to learn healthier eating habits.
If you give them too much sugar, their palate becomes so accustomed to sweet food, and then they don't want to eat things like sprouts, sweet potatoes, broccoli.
But can or should the government push people toward different foods? Mark Littlewood with the Institute of Economic Affairs says no.
I think sometimes those from or around the medical profession just get irritated that free people don't behave exactly as they would wish.
The World Health Organization estimates that some 40 million kids were overweight in 2013. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
A new television movie looks at a significant moment in country singer Dolly Parton's childhood. International Edition's Sarah Williams speaks about it with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong.
Well, as the holidays approach here in the United States, many inspiring stories of faith and family come to life on the small screen. One of those TV movies includes the story of one of country music's icons, Dolly Parton. Her new film, Coat of Many Colors, is a snapshot of her life as a 9-year-old girl overcoming a family tragedy while living in poverty in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee in 1955. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here with more details. Well, Nikki, this movie, Coat of Many Colors, is actually based on Dolly Parton's signature hit of the same name.
Yes, and Dolly Parton says that the song is one of her, actually her favorite song that she has ever written. It was released in October 1971 from the album of the same name. And the song itself tells a story of how her mom stitched together a coat for Dolly made out of rags that were given to her family. And as she sewed the coat, her mom would share the biblical story of Joseph and his coat of many colors, in which his father Jacob or Israel gave Joseph this fancy coat as a gift because Joseph was his favorite son. And Joseph, like Dolly, is also one out of 12 children. However, when Dolly wore this coat to school, she was ridiculed and teased about it. But by the end of the song, she realizes that despite being poor, according to the world standards, that coat was far richer than all the material gain in the world. Now, in the movie, we get a deeper meaning behind the song. Dolly has never been ashamed of where she's come from. Her dad and her mom married as teenagers. They were dirt poor. Her dad never had a chance to go to school, but he was a hard worker. And she says her mom had a faith that would move mountains and a love for her dad that just would not quit. And Dolly says that her mother would give each of her siblings a baby. You know, this is your baby, meaning you'll take care of him, you'll feed him, you'll change the diaper as well. The baby that was supposed to be Dolly's dies, and her mother goes into a deep depression. And then during this time is when she makes the coat for Dolly. And so the coat then becomes symbolic of stitching the pieces of life back together after this loss. And once Dolly starts getting teased for wearing it, it also becomes a means of personal transformation as little Dolly learns to determine her own self-worth versus anchoring her worth in the shallow opinions of others. So the coat really becomes an anchor in the film, signifying resiliency, renewal, faith, and most importantly, love.
So tell us about the cast. Dolly Parton handpicked many of the actors.
Yeah, Dolly picked Ricky Schroeder to play her father. She said he reminded her so much of her father. She said he looks like his people, his body structure. And Ricky Schroeder and his wife actually lost a child too. So doing the film really hit home for his family as well. Country music star Jennifer Nettles plays her mom. I was surprised by this too. Dolly says Jennifer sent her an audition tape and she flipped out. She said when she heard Jennifer reading the role, she thought, oh my Lord, that's mama. And she said that people are going to be blown away by Jennifer's performance. Olivia Lynn plays Dolly as a child and she was chosen out of hundreds of children. And Dolly's sister is in it too. She plays the church lady who brings the rags to make the coat.
This film is also the first in a series Dolly Parton is doing with NBC.
Yeah, it is. Coat of Many Colors is the first in a series of movies Dolly is making. Jolene, based on her 1974 hit, will be the next film.
I love that song.
Oh, my God. Very different story. That's going to be juicy. I can't wait. Coat of Many Colors airs December 10th, 9 p.m. Eastern on NBC. And you can actually take a look at a lengthy preview of it on our Facebook page. You can just go to VOA Music and you can get a sneak peek there.
You can hear music from Dolly Parton and many other country music artists on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong. You can also reach Nikki on Twitter at @VOA_music or on Facebook at VOA Music. Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you.
There were rags of many colors, but every piece was small, and I didn't have a coat. It was a way down.
The 2016 VOA calendar is ready. This year it features 12 photographs of New York City. If you would like one, please send your snail mail address by email to calendar@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama recently addressed the American people following the terrorist attack in San Bernardino, California, which left 14 people dead and some 21 injured. This was an act of terrorism, said President Obama, designed to kill innocent people. The United States has been at war with terrorism since Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 Americans on 9/11. But over the years, the terrorist threat has evolved into a new phase. Terrorists have turned to less complicated acts of violence, like the mass shootings that have occurred all over the world in recent weeks. The United States has a plan to overcome this evolving threat, said President Obama.
We will destroy ISIL and any other organization that tries to harm us. Our success won't depend on tough talk or abandoning our values or giving in to fear. That's what groups like ISIL are hoping for. Instead, we will prevail by being strong and smart, resilient and relentless, and by drawing upon every aspect of American power.
Specifically, the U.S. military will continue to hunt down terrorist plotters in any country where it is necessary. In Iraq and Syria, airstrikes are taking out ISIL leaders, heavy weapons, oil tankers, and infrastructure. The U.S. continues to train and equip tens of thousands of Iraqi and Syrian forces fighting ISIL on the ground in order to take away their safe havens. U.S. intelligence is working to disrupt ISIL's plots, cut off their financing, and prevent them from recruiting fighters. With American leadership, the international community has begun to establish a timeline to pursue ceasefires and a political resolution to the Syrian war. This strategy to destroy ISIL is supported by U.S. military commanders and counterterrorism experts, together with 65 countries that have joined an American-led coalition. We will succeed in this mission, said President Obama. Americans have always met challenges, whether war or depression, natural disasters or terrorist attacks, by coming together around our common ideals as one nation, as one people. So long as we stay true to that tradition, I have no doubt America will prevail.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.